On the show today, peak oil and hydropower, women entrepreneurs, oh, and sneakers. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, October 24th. Good to have you with us. Global demand for fossil fuels is expected to peak by the end of this decade as the transition to cleaner energy sources picks up speed. That's from a new report out today by the International Energy Agency. And yes, it comes amidst a recent wave of oil company mergers as the industry keeps investing in production. One renewable energy source that we already heavily rely on is hydropower. But as weather becomes more unpredictable, dam operators and planners have the increasingly challenging task of managing the extremes of flood and drought. Saqib Rahim is a climate journalist and wrote in Wired about some new forecasting techniques that might help. Saqib, welcome to the program.
Hi, Amy.
So how, generally speaking, is the climate crisis making it harder to manage these large dams that often are an important provider of power for their communities?
So I've been covering renewable energy for a while, and the way that people always talk about hydropower is it's sort of the old reliable of the renewable energy world. It's something like 60% of all renewable energy in the world comes from hydropower. But the thing is, dams, by definition, have been built to previous climate regimes, and we're now entering this new climate regime.
You write about this pilot program with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that's meant to help dam operators better manage water when it's coming or when there isn't enough of it. It's called Forecast-Informed Reservoir Operations. How does that work?
FIRO, fun name. The way it works is it takes advantage of improvements in weather forecasting technology. Now, over on the West Coast, the major way they get rain and snow is from these things called atmospheric rivers. Those were in the news earlier this year. I think there were 31 of them in California that just hit back to back.
Right.
And these enterprising scientists started flying out above these storms and dropping sensors into them. And what you get is a really detailed picture of what a given atmospheric river is doing. You can tell kind of where, when, and how much water is going to hit.
Give me an example of how this program helps someone at a dam predict what's coming and act accordingly.
So traditionally, the way you run a dam is you basically aren't allowed to use weather forecasts. You're supposed to wait.
Wait a minute. That is so weird. Can you just say why you weren't actually allowed to use weather forecasting?
Yeah, that's a traditional way of doing things. Weather forecasts were not considered that reliable. And if you basically make a bet and you're wrong about that bet, really dangerous things can happen.
Huh. Okay. So now FIRO comes along and it says, yeah, please use these forecasts. Makes sense.
Yeah, FIRO is a way of seeing if we can use weather forecasting to get better results. And what they're finding is, yes, you can get better results. I talked to a dam operator in Northern California who said, I now have visibility at 5 days that I used to have only at two. You can do whatever you want with those 3 days. You can either use some of that water to run your hydropower turbines. You can bank some of it for drinking water. You can do any number of things that kind of hue to what your goal is as a dam.
And so you talk in the story about Prado Dam near Los Angeles and how it was able to take advantage of forecasting. Can you describe how this pilot allowed the dam operators to do something they couldn't have done before or not as well?
This story is so cool because Prado Dams is really, really old dam. But essentially what they did was, without any new infrastructure, they used the weather forecast to see these atmospheric rivers that are coming for us are pretty well spaced out. Hmm. Now, why that matters at Prado Dam is they have this network of, colloquially, I would say sponges, right? Where they can release water into these sponges and they'll soak into the ground. And now you've got groundwater. Because those storms were so well spaced out and they knew that, they were able to time the exact cadence of releases into those sponges, as I'm calling them, and they were able to bank really the maximum amount of water that you possibly could.
So this pilot now is at half a dozen sites in the U.S. Do you see this scaling up significantly?
They say they're scaling up significantly. Now, one thing to keep in mind here is that atmospheric rivers have gotten a lot more predictable in the last 10 years, but a lot of the precipitation events in other parts of the United States have not. For example, Midwest thunderstorms, those are like beyond the cutting edge of what scientists feel they can forecast confidently right now. So the challenge for all the FIRO pilots going forward is to basically get better at predicting Mother Nature and integrating that into how the reservoirs in that part of the country operate.
All right. Saqib Rahim is a climate journalist who wrote about forecast-informed reservoir operations, or FIRO, in Wired. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your time, Amy.
And if you want to hear more about solutions to water challenges, check out the podcast I host, How We Survive. We're out with a new season now, The Worth of Water, wherever you listen to podcasts. Oil, by the way, down today, off 2%. Equities, though, opposite direction. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you caught the show yesterday, you heard Kimberly Adams talk about that $1.7 trillion budget deficit the Treasury Department just announced for FY 2023 and the role shrinking tax revenue played in that number. Well, today, another slice of that story. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains the role of the Federal Reserve.
The Federal Reserve. It manages interest rates, fights inflation, promotes employment, and can make money doing it.
For about 15 years, the Fed's been making about $100 billion a year.
Joe Gagnon is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute, which is a marketplace underwriter. The Fed hands that profit right on over to the Treasury to do whatever with. But where does that money come from? Well, you might remember a little thing called
quantitative easing.
Quantitative easing.
Quantitative easing.
This was the Fed's strategy to help the economy out, starting in the great financial crisis and again in the pandemic, by going out and buying tons of bonds and mortgage-backed securities. Today, the Fed still owns trillions of dollars worth of those bonds and securities that pay interest. Not a lot, but
on average, over time, it makes a fair amount of money.
Bill English is a professor at the Yale School of Management. But the Fed also has to spend money. The Fed is, among other things, a bank for banks, and it pays interest to those banks. When interest rates were low, it wasn't paying much, less than 1%. But now,
it's now paying interest on reserves of 5.5% or so. So the interest expense is now greater than the interest income, and the Fed has lost on the order of $100 billion since last fall.
When the Fed has a loss, it does not just suck money out of the Treasury or taxes. It files the loss away until it can pay it back once it's making a profit again. But the U.S. Treasury does not get its free money. Mark Goldwine is with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
So compared to last year, we're more than $100 billion down.
Now, that only accounts for around 5% of the current deficit.
It really is Congress and the president that should be held accountable for our level of borrowing.
It is not the Fed's job, he says, to be a golden goose for the Treasury. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Earlier this month, the economic historian and labor economist Claudia Golden won the Nobel Prize for Economics for her research into the gender pay gap. Golden has looked, for example, at how women who have children often give up jobs with long hours and higher pay for jobs with more flexibility and less pay. After the prize was announced, Marketplace's Justin Ho heard from one of his sources, an entrepreneur, who wrote that she had some thoughts on the subject, specifically that entrepreneurship, starting a business, can be one way for women to get both the pay and the flexibility they need. So Justin talked with her and a few other women who've started businesses about why entrepreneurship can be part of the solution.
Back in 2018, Madeline Reeves was working in business development for a tech company. She's the one who wrote the email. She headed to a conference in San Francisco to network and represent her company, just like she had dozens of times before during her 3 years at the company. But one difference this time, she was carrying a 2-week-old baby.
This woman, she saw me. I was in line for like yet another coffee because I just wasn't sleeping much during this season of my life. And she looked at me and she was like, do you have a baby on you?
Reeves said, yep, it's a baby.
You know, I kind of tilted my chest forward so she could peek in because he was sleeping. And she was like, that's amazing. And I don't know if it was amazing.
Reeves says, on one hand, she understands the woman's reaction. Men still dominate the tech industry. But on the other hand, she felt staying at home with her baby would have been better for both of them.
But I would think there was a part of me that was so scared that I would not be able to continue my career if I didn't show up in these key moments.
Reeves realized that she needed more flexibility, so she asked if she could work remotely 2 days a week.
And instead, the company countered and said, why don't you just step back and you can work 3 days a week and you can have 3/5 of your salary and you can just only work part-time.
Reeves says that was not an option. So she quit and started her own marketing and consulting company, Fearless Foundry. Reeves says even though she works long hours, she decides when to work. And she says she's on track to earn as much as she used to after 5 pretty boom and bust years. But none of this, she says, was a choice she wanted to make.
I've had enough conversations behind closed doors with different women who have done the same thing. And a lot of us don't feel like it was necessarily a choice. It was like, we have to do this because otherwise, you know, we're going to make sacrifices that we cannot live with.
Even though entrepreneurship can help women get the pay and flexibility they deserve, it's not a guarantee.
My salary is still pretty modest.
That's Brandilyn Green, who runs Voice of Hair, a company that makes hair products for women of color. A couple years after launching her first product in 2018, she says the company was pulling in a profit, but
that didn't all go into my pocket. Some of that had to go back into the business to re-up on inventory, you know?
Green says she still misses the stability of the regular paycheck she got when she worked in a big company's marketing department. But running her own business gives her the time she wants to spend with her 3 kids. And that, she says, is a lot more valuable.
I'd rather, like, make slightly less as an entrepreneur, have more flexibility and be able to be there for my kids than make 10 times what I make, have no time, not the ability to go to their, you know, swim practice or soccer games.
Green admits that being able to rely on her partner's health insurance, as did all of the women entrepreneurs in this piece, helped her launch her business. And that question of the balance between how much money you're making and how much you're working doesn't go away even after you've become a successful entrepreneur. Sophie Blake opened the store to sell the jewelry she designs back in 2016. And after her daughter was born 3 years later,
I went back from maternity a month later. And that is crazy if you think about it. You shouldn't have to do that as a young mom.
Blake says she had to because she was the business. As the designer, people came to her store to shop with her. But about a year ago, Blake says she decided to close the physical store and go online only. A big reason was her family.
That was 90% of the decision because I realized that I was missing out on very vital time with my family on weekends because I had to be in the store all the time. And I didn't want to pass up the opportunity to watch my daughter grow up.
Blake says the decision gave her more flexibility, but it didn't give her more pay. Still, she says she's not worried since the business has been doing really well.
It was almost like empowering to say, you know what? I value time with my child more than making an extra buck here and there. When I said that to myself, I was like, yeah, this feels right. Absolutely.
And the money, Blake says, that'll come with time. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
How did it feel after it was done? Is euphoria too strong?
Nope, not too strong at all. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 204.6% to finish at 33,141. The NASDAQ rose 121.9% to close at 13,139. And the S&P 500 was up 30.7% to end at 4,247. We heard about how changing weather patterns are affecting hydro dams. Looking at some hydropower stocks, Brookfield Renewable Corp was up 2.2%. Duke Energy gained 1.6%. The Energy Information Administration says the 60 million or so homes heated with natural gas could be looking at lower bills this winter due to a natural gas surplus. Bills could be $601 on average, about 21% less than last year. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.82%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. The Biden administration is proposing some big changes to the H-1B program. That's the visa program that allows U.S. employers to fill specialized jobs by sponsoring highly skilled workers from outside the country who have at least a bachelor's degree or equivalent. So think people who work in tech, IT. One of the issues is that there are a lot more people who want H-1Bs and companies who want to hire them than there are visas to go around. And some companies have been gaming the system. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
There aren't many ways to come to the U.S. legally to work. H-1B visas are a big one.
If you know of a scientist or doctor or engineer who immigrated to the United States, chances are pretty good that they came through the H-1B program.
But Jeremy Neufeld at the nonprofit Institute for Progress says the visas are hard to get, especially to work at a for-profit company.
The number of H-1Bs for them is capped at 85,000 a year, and those 85,000 are awarded by lottery.
Some companies have been submitting multiple applications for the same person, basically buying extra lottery tickets. If the administration's proposed rule goes through, they won't be able to anymore. Ron Hira at Howard University says there would be other changes, too.
There's a number of employers who are exempt from the cap. Those are universities, they're research organizations. They're proposing to expand that quite significantly.
They're also proposing allowing entrepreneurs to sponsor themselves for H-1Bs, says Gaurav Khanna at the University of California, San Diego. And
they're trying to make sure that there's less fraud, so they're going to do some on-site inspections. They are going to try to make it easier for international students who've come to the U.S. on a student visa to transition to an H-1B.
Change to the H-1B program has been a long time coming, says Muzaffar Chishti at the Nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute, but
what it doesn't address is that these are extremely small numbers for 21st century global economy.
But increasing the number of H-1Bs is not something the administration could do. That would be up to Congress. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
For a long time, school cafeterias have been serving up more than lunch. Many of them also provide breakfast. And schools with high levels of poverty often serve an after-school meal, too. But the number of students taking that supper, as it's often called, fell by almost a quarter between 2021 and 22. That's the finding of a report out today from the nonprofit Food Research and Action Center. It's the largest decline since after-school meals became an option more than a decade ago. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more.
The after-school meal known as supper can be served as early as 2:45 at Charleston County School District in South Carolina.
Because the kids are hungry.
Walter Campbell is executive director of nutrition services there. The meal includes a protein, a grain, a fruit or veg, and milk. One favorite is a hot ham and cheese sandwich. And Campbell says he can see the difference these meals make.
I think having a meal after school before they have their homework and having the time to eat that meal impacts their mood. I mean, food absolutely impacts their mood.
But Charleston is among the places that's seen a drop in the number of students eating those meals. One reason, it's been hard to find staff for after school programs where the meals are served. Clarissa Hayes is the primary author of that new report from the Food Research and Action Center.
So they just could not get enough staff to serve the meals, run the activities, and that really impacted participation.
Hayes says inflation played a role too.
So even buying bread, for example, or fruit or vegetables or things that they buy all the time for these programs were higher than normal. So they just weren't able to make the cost of the meal fit underneath the federal reimbursement that they were getting.
Also, to be eligible for the program, 50% of a school's students must qualify for free or reduced cost lunch. During the pandemic, the federal government lifted that requirement, but now it's back in place, and that limits which schools can take part. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Justin Ho's story earlier about women and entrepreneurship got us thinking about one of our regulars. Vanita Cooper is an entrepreneur. She runs Silhouette Sneakers and Art in the historic Greenwood District of Tulsa, Oklahoma. We gave her a call to see how things are going.
I just looked at my numbers for quarter three, and we're down actually almost 50% from last year. We've definitely got to do some things to ensure we finish the year off strong. I kind of sensed it intuitively. We had some really slow days where we might only have a couple of customers come in. And then I just knew that my attention was being pulled elsewhere because I've been so focused on, one, preparing for our annual sneaker soiree, which happened on October 6th. And then the launch of an app that I'm working on called Arbit. It was just a really funky quarter. The sneaker soiree was basically like friends and family of Silhouette. We had 300 people come out. And it's a celebration of sneakers. It's a celebration of Black culture. It's a celebration of community. This is our third year. In the first 2 years, a local institution really took the lead on that event. But this year, I took the lead. And let me tell you, I had an event planner, and it still really stressed me out. How did it feel after it was done? Is euphoria too strong? I mean, it was on a Friday. And then that whole weekend, I was like, I just need this whole weekend to myself. I even went to a restaurant and had brunch. I'd like took a book with me. I mean, a whole weight was lifted off my shoulder. I would love to obviously see an increase in sales. We'll be able to mitigate some of the loss created by this market downturn is just having organizations in the community who are like, hey, like, you know, let's do custom sneakers for everybody on our team, or, you know, taking our shop on the road to different sneaker trade shows. You know, I love sneakers, but I also just really love markets. And there are opportunities to be had in down markets, right? And so to me, it's not like, oh, things are harder now. It's no more fun. It's like, these are some different challenges. And I'm an entrepreneur, so I'm going to lean into the things that got me here to figure out how to crack the code on these challenges.
Vanita Cooper, running Silhouette Sneakers and Art, and now Arbit out of Tulsa, Oklahoma. This final note on the way out today, one more story about women in the workforce, which we spotted on Axios. We know technology is always coming for our jobs, but the think tank Third Way is out with a new analysis showing who will pay the biggest price. The report says in the next decade, 2/3 of jobs lost in the most impacted industries are currently held by women without college degrees. Many of the jobs disappearing are middle-wage occupations, including administrative assistants, customer service reps, and factory workers, jobs that traditionally offered good pay, benefits, and security. Here's your moment of economic context on the way out. By my calendar, it's Taco Tuesday, and CNN reports the lone holdout still clinging to its trademark of the term, Gregory's Restaurant and Bar in Summers Point, New Jersey, gave up its claim this week after 40 years, under legal pressure, of course, from Taco Bell. The rival chain Taco John's gave up its trademark in the other 49 states back in July to avoid an expensive legal battle. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital and on-demand. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.